This week on Writers, Inc.
The agent's job, big part of the agent's job is just relationships. And so one of my criteria with looking for agents was, I can't have more relationships than you.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
Live from San Francisco, it's J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So right before we hopped on, I got an email from BookBub. They're doing a new BookBub like email announcement thingy that you can subscribe to now for books that just entered Kindle Unlimited. So if you've got a book you just put into Kindle Unlimited, they've got a basically a mailing list now that they're putting together where they can notify people this book is brand new in Kindle Unlimited. Which,
Very cool.
I think that could be cool. Like I tend to release everything wide and then after 90 days, I put it into KU. So like that gives me one more opportunity to blast, you know, that out there. But it jumped out at me just because, you know, it's BookBub doing something a little bit different. Cause you know, for like the last year or two, like it felt like BookBub's been kind of like on a decline. And you know, it's nice to see them pivoting a little bit.
Yeah. There was a point where, I made back three times whatever I spent on BookBub, on the feature deals or whatever. And now I can, every now and then I'll have like a barely scrape by break even kind of done. So
yeah, that's how my last few have been too. And like, it's honestly turned me off to the process. Like it's not worth it if you're not making a, you know, a guaranteed profit. And I definitely don't want to do it if it might be, you know, something that's in the red.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I think I have a little side news.
Oh, we like
to throw out there.
Yeah.
So an author that we all know and love started his own Substack writing about true crime. Have we talked about that yet?
Oh yeah.
No, we haven't talked about that. So what I'm doing, all I'm doing is once a week I'm posting an article about an unsolved murder. Which, you know, I was trying to find an angle that I could, you know, something I could do where I could hit Substack on a regular basis, you know, that was fairly easy to do. And these are kind of fun because, you know, you read them, I'm trying to keep it under 1,000 words. So you can basically, you know, hear about some, you know, unsolved case somewhere. And like I comb these all the time looking for ideas for stories. And that's why I figured I'd throw them out there. What's going on in the news? The actual news. The real news.
Speaking of murders, 11 Labs releases the Odyssey audiobook narrated by Sir Michael Caine's AI voice. See where the murder part comes in? They're murdering his dignity. 11 Labs has released a full AI-produced audiobook of the Odyssey using a licensed AI clone of Michael Caine's voice, along with 20 additional AI voices, music, and sound effects. The project was designed as a showcase for what AI narration can do. Despite using AI voices, the production still required significant human involvement. Four producers reportedly spent 6 weeks creating the 13-hour audiobook, showing that high-quality AI audio productions are far from fully automated. Early reactions have been mixed. While the technology is impressive, reviewers noted that emotional scenes often felt flat, with characters lacking the intensity, fear, or anger that a skilled human narrator might bring to the performance.
Oh, silly question, but is Michael Caine still alive?
You know,
oh, I thought he was not, but now that you say that.
I'm honestly not sure. I don't remember him.
Oh, he's still alive.
Oh, is he?
Okay.
He is 93 years old.
Yeah, okay. I didn't remember a notice or anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is going to fall in that same problem they have with it with anybody else who uses AI as a voice. It doesn't have a soul to it, like, and it's very difficult to follow. Like, you listen to it, it sounds perfect, it mimics the voice perfectly, but it's lacking whatever that element is that tells us that this is something we should actually pay attention to. It's like listening to white noise.
Yeah, the emotionality and like those slight nuances in vocal delivery. I mean, I guess, you know, we experience that in normal audiobooks, right? Like there are some audio narrators that are just better than others because they're just able to deliver better. They're not just reading the text, they're actually like acting it, being a voice actor versus just a narrator. So,
I really think it
yeah.
goes beyond that. I think that human element not being there, our brain just does not want to pay attention to it. It tunes it out.
Yeah.
And the only thing I can compare it to is like we've got a forest behind our house. And if I'm standing in that forest, like just facing in the opposite direction, and somebody else walks into that forest or an animal is out there, like a deer or something, like I know. And like you can sense that that other thing is there, like that presence is there. And I think in audiobook narrations, it's the same thing. If that human element is missing, our brain just it writes it off, like it not something that we need to listen to. And I don't know that they're going to be able to overcome that particular hurdle.
Probably not.
No, I don't know how you fake emotion. Like that would be a very complex programming algorithm of, predicting which words go with what emotion. And yeah, I don't know. That sounds very likely, nearly impossible.
I've been faking emotion for years.
Oh my
Well, not
God,
that hard.
Kevin. Yeah.
Right, next up, Porter Square Books launches book review. Porter Square Books has launched a new publication called the Porter Square Book Review of Books, which will publish regular reviews of new releases across adult, children's, and genre categories. Reviews will be written by booksellers and writers in residence. The bookstore says that the project is a response to the ongoing decline of professional book coverage, noting that newspaper book sections and traditional review outlets have been shrinking for years, making it harder for readers to discover new books. Store co-owner Josh Cook argues that booksellers already do much of the work of reviewing books every day, reading, evaluating, and recommending titles to customers, so creating a dedicated review publication felt like a natural next step.
I really hope these guys are smart enough to get an email address that's not from Gmail when they start, soliciting authors to do this.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it will be good. I don't know if you remember, we had Josh Cook on the show a while ago with when we were talking about booksellers, and he's always doing innovative kind of stuff. He's I think his store is like a co-op. It's like a co-ownership, and he's written a lot of books on indie stores and fighting against Amazon, and he's been a pretty big voice out there. So I think this is great. Like he said, booksellers are kind of the tastemakers anyway in the indie bookstores. So if indie bookstores start having lists that people like, I think that's only a good thing to get more
What's
exposure.
interesting to
I
me is
agree, yeah.
I can honestly say I have never in my life bought a book because I read a review about it. And I know I'm
Really?
probably an oddball, yeah, but I just don't see the value in reading a review for a book.
Oh
Or a
man.
movie or anything else, honestly.
I read reviews quite a lot, actually. One-star reviews are usually how I can tell if I'm going to love something or hate it, because those tend to be super honest. And then they'll tell you what their issues with the book are. And sometimes, like everything they list, you're like, I don't know, that sounds like my kind of jam. And you
Yeah,
end up
that's a
buying.
good point. I do look at negative reviews, but
Yeah.
mostly just for the
Yeah.
smiles. But
But I have read like positive reviews that make me curious about a book. If I'm on the fence about a book, a review can sway me to give it a shot.
Does it have to be a professional review, or
Oh
would
no.
you?
I have read
That's what I'm
both,
saying.
like
Yeah,
on
that's what I'm
Goodreads,
saying.
but I do enjoy the professional reviews. I think that they're kind of interesting to see. I think if you particularly are kind of going after a traditional publishing, like kind of more commercial route, reading those traditional reviews kind of put you into what that commercial space is looking for and what they think about and like how they view. It's not like for me, it's not about the specific book they're writing about. It's kind of more that overview of like what themes they're picking out. Like what drew them to that book? Why do they like it? Why are they reviewing it? Or why are they panning it?
Yeah. And you get your reviewers that you find your taste is similar to as well. And then you'll kind of follow them. And yeah. Yeah, I like reviews. One star reviews are great. Too much murder, too many curses. We're in, right? Okay.
Well, a lot of these industry reviews tend to open doors for, like libraries tend to read a lot of these types of things. Other bookstores tend to read these types of things. It's funny as this sounds, like I don't actually read book reviews. Like when I buy a book, like if a friend recommends something to me or like I hear about it, like I typically just go in and just buy it. But like I just bought a pressure washer, and like I read like all 33 reviews over at Lowe's before I pulled the trigger on it. But when it comes to a book, like I've never, just because like when you go through them, like you get, you know, there's such a mix of people, you know, some like it, some don't like it. And like I walk away without any real, you know, education on whether I'll like it.
I literally walked into a Barnes & Noble the other day and decided I would pick up any book at random to read. And that meant I picked up The Lighthouse at the End of the World. You guys seen this book?
I've seen it, but I haven't read it.
Philip A. Sugars. I didn't know anything about it. It hasn't grabbed me yet, but it turned out it's like a contemporary fantasy book, so was not expecting that.
I love going into books blind. I mean, I do that a lot because I review books, and you know, a lot of times they just get assigned to me, and so I don't bother reading the blurb, because why, just go in and read it and see what happens. So I'll just, you know, randomly pick things on my Kindle sometimes and just read it, and it's kind of fun figuring out what genre and what's going on.
Yeah. All right. Final story. Former Tinder CEO named president of Entangled. Entangled Publishing has hired the former Tinder CEO as its new president and COO, as the publisher wants to grow beyond books and become a broader media and entertainment company. The new CEO brings experience from Tinder, SoundCloud, Viacom, and Warner Brothers, where she focused on building large consumer communities and using AI-driven personalization to keep audiences engaged. Entangled says it plans to expand into franchise development, fan experiences, events, and community building, giving readers more ways to interact with stories and authors beyond buying books.
I love this.
Yeah.
Entangled, they always have been, I think, when it comes to interesting marketing, one of the publishers that I think has done, they always have interesting marketing for their books. And now that they've expanded into new imprints and they're bringing, you know, I think it's time we start swiping. What's the swipe right? Is that good? I don't know.
Yeah, I've actually never used Tinder because, yeah, I think I've been in a relationship since before Tinder was a thing. But
What Tinder is?
Yeah, it's a dating,
like a dating
one.
App?
It's a dating site. Yeah.
Oh.
Like the swipe right site.
But, okay, well that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, no, I think it's cool because I mean it just goes to show that a lot of publishers are looking outside of what they've been doing for new ways to build community and new experiences for fans. So I think it's gonna be a lot of fun. Maybe we'll get this Tinder app for books, binder, swipe right on that. If you want to read this book.
Swipe right for a book boyfriend.
Yeah. Ooh.
Keep talking. I've got ChatGPT listening in.
Yeah, I think this it'll be interesting. I mean, Simon & Schuster was kind of the first one, right? When they ended up getting bought by someone outside of publishing and kind of, you know, exploring different routes. So I'm all for this. I think it's exciting.
Yeah, it's fun for sure. All right. JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Maurice Broaddus coming on. Maurice is a fantasy and horror author best known for his short fiction. He's published dozens of stories in magazines and book anthologies, including Asimov Science Fiction, Black Static, and Weird Tales. His latest novel is called A City Dreaming, which has been described as Black Panther meets The Expanse, and releases June 30th. Here he is, Maurice Broaddus.
So, you have a new book coming out. you do. A City Dreaming, which is book 3 in your Astra Black series. And it's been described as, I think, Black Panther meets The Expanse, meets Game of Thrones, which is a fantastic comparison. And yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But we have a lot of writers who listen to this show. So let's start at the beginning. With your origin story, how did you get into this business? How did you get started writing?
Well, those are two different questions.
Take it any way you want.
All right. So I got started writing because So I was actually born in London, and then we moved to America when I was young. I was 6 years old. So I moved from London, England, to that booming metropolis known as Franklin, Indiana. And they did not know what grade to put me in, so they ended up skipping me into like second grade. And they knew they probably should have put me in third, but they're just like, "Yeah, you're already the youngest and smallest kid in the class, plus the only black kid in the class. So why don't we just we'll leave you in second." And so, but then my teacher, who I mean, her name was Mrs. Rainey. I'll never forget. And then she just said, "Look," she gave me a stack of blank paper. And just set me in the back of the class and get, said, "Just create stuff. That's your school year." And I'm just like, man, the American school system is great. And so yeah, so that whole year, all I did, I made like little prayer books and poetry books and story books, and that's all I did. And I didn't realize at the time that I was learning the discipline of writing at the time. By fifth grade, I think I'd gotten an honorable mention in a citywide essay contest. By high school, my teachers my teachers recognized I had a pretty good talent at writing, and so they gave me my own curriculum and own reading schedule. We'll put a pin in that because right now it sounds all glorious about, oh man, they recognized my genius early. Da, 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 da. Having now been a teacher, I now realize what they did. Because you give an assignment like, "Hey, for the next semester, we're going to put together a 15-page, do all this work to put together a 15-page essay, or a 15-page report." Da, da, da. Yeah, 15 pages is nothing to me, so I did it overnight. I'm now done with the assignment that's supposed to take us the entire semester to do, which means I got the entire semester to just jack around in class. And they were like, "Uh-oh." So suddenly I have a special curriculum that they want me to do. So I'm like, "Oh, okay." So looking back, I realized what was going on, but it's like, okay.
I love it. It's differentiated instruction, giving you
And,
advanced learning opportunities, right?
hey, perfect, perfect. Not we're trying to keep the troublemaker busy.
That's it.
And then by then in college, I'd actually quit writing so I could focus on being a biology major. But then I think after 2 years, I had this itch, and I was like, "Something's not right with my life." And it was just I have to be writing something. And so I ended up using a lot of my electives to take to pursue a writing classes. And I knew I was on the right track when I had this independent studies course. And they randomly pair you up with a professor. And I told him where I was in my journey and everything, wanted to be a horror writer and all that kind of stuff. And he's like, "Well, did you research us beforehand?" And I'm like, "No, they pair us up randomly." And he goes, "Yeah, I did my dissertation in Stephen King and Clive Barker." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So that's when I knew I was on the right track in as far as my direction of writing. So that was 93, and I ended up getting an honorable mention in the Isaac Asimov's undergraduate writing contest. Got an honorable mention for that. That was 93. But so then skip ahead a decade. That's when I actually entered the business. I start going to writers' conferences. My first conference was the World Horror Conference in 2002. I won an honorable mention in that contest too. There's a lot of honorable mentions along the way, so I'm close. I'm always so close. But then the next year, I did win the short story contest. So I'm like, finally, that's when I'm like, oh, I've broken through now because I won that contest. Part of the prize for winning that contest was they published me in Weird Tales magazine, and
Oh, that's
so now I
awesome.
have my first major credit on top of that. And so then I'm just off to the races at that point.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, opportunities to do what you were good at young, plus the right mentor. It's so nice when people get support. We don't get enough of those.
Well, I mean, and you say that, and I'm looking back, and it's like always when I was ready to take the next step, there was a mentor to come along. So getting to World Horror, for example, I didn't know anything about that side of the business. I knew I'd finished a novel, and no one tells you what to do with a novel once you're done with it.
Correct.
And so what I ended up doing is I'm a big comic book collector.
Yeah.
And so I wrote my favorite comic book. It was a Starman. James Robinson was the writer, so I write into the comic book and I just lay it out. Like, here, I'm a horror writer. I've just finished a book and I don't know what to do next. And can you help me out? And he publishes the letter in the comic book. And then, but his only reply was, "Man, I probably should do an advice column for writers." And that was all that he actually said. But because they published my letter and my address, about 3 weeks later, I got a letter in the mail. And it's this writer, his name's Wayne Allen Sally. And he's like, "World Horror is going to be up in Chicago this year. That's only like a 3 hours from you. Why don't you come up and then I'll introduce you to some folks." And that's literally what happened. I met up. It's fun trying to explain to my wife, "Okay, honey, I'm going to go to this conference, meet connect with a guy I've never met before. He can introduce me to a bunch of people I don't know." Like,
But you know what?
okay.
That really is the way to do it. Like
Oh,
for
yeah.
people who are starting out, make friends. Go
Make
to
friends.
conferences and conventions and make friends. That's it.
Absolutely. And the friends I made at that World Horror in particular, I'm thinking back and I got, there's at least a half dozen of them that became lifelong friends. I mean, they're
Yeah.
my friends to this day.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's how we met. We met at Confusion. I was hungry and I didn't know anyone. And I said, please adopt me. And we had dinner together. So
Right, like, come on,
that
because that's what happened to me at World Horror. Because I all of a sudden, like, Linda Addison's like, "Well, come on, have dinner with us." And I'm like, "All right, who's us?" And it's like me, Linda, Gary Brombeck, Tom Piccirilli. I'm like, "Y'all do know y'all are legends in the industry." "Well, would y'all invite me?" And they're like, "Come on, no, you're come on, join us, have fun." I'll go, "Okay."
Yeah.
So.
I mean, the writer community for the most part is amazing. Everyone is friendly. No one is like, even if they're many steps ahead of you, they want to help, new authors out. And every
Right.
convention I've been to has been wonderful meeting people. So, yeah.
Yes.
Highly recommend. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got your first horror novel. Is that the one you ended up publishing? Was that your debut or what happened with that?
No, that novel actually never saw the light of day. In fact, my first four novels never saw the light of day.
Yeah.
But the fifth novel, Kingmaker, that became my first novel published. And so that began my Knights of Breton Court series. And so and I wrote it as a coming of age horror novel. But then when the publisher bought it, they were just like, "Oh, nope, we're gonna do this as an urban fantasy novel." So I'm like,
Okay.
"Okay, what about all the zombies in it, Larry? It'll be fine. It'll be fine." I'm like, "Okay." And so that became my first novel published. And yeah, and then it was just a matter of like, all right, I guess I'm in it now.
So, did you go direct to publisher or did you find an agent for that or?
Oh, I went, most of my career has been, exactly what you just said. I make friends
Yeah.
and then figure out the business side of it later. So I'd made friends, and that's how I got the opportunity over at Angry Robot, was through friends connecting me and everything. And then I got the publishing deal, but now I have this 14-page contract in front of me, and I'm like, I should probably get an agent.
Yes.
And so I asked some friends of mine, about their agents, everything. They recommended me their agent, so I went with him for a while. And so we rode together through that trilogy. And then not too long after that, I ended up switching agents because things had just sort of stalled out. I ended up switching agents, and then but partly with the new agent is I got her because I was like, my next book out is going to be a middle grade detective novel, which is a huge break from my horror writing or urban fantasy writing. So we went out with that book. That was The Usual Suspects, and then that also began my side quest career in publishing middle grade detective novels on the side.
Yeah, I mean, we don't talk about that a lot. Like, a lot of authors have multiple agents throughout their career just because they don't represent, like, if you want to switch genres, they don't have the contacts for that, right? So you got to find someone who has those contacts. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, the agent's job, big part of the agent's job is just relationships.
Yep.
And so one of my criteria with looking for agents was I can't have more relationships than you.
Right.
If I do, then I literally do not need you,
Yeah.
at least for that intro part of thing. And so, me and my agent, and then the agent I've had since then, because my agent, my then agent, she retired for a while and then sort of passed me on to her best friend, which was handy because her best friend had heard all of my antics as a writer, because they all talk. And so that way, none of my antics would surprise her.
Yeah.
Because in between, I had like what I call the interim agent between those two, and that did not last long at all. She was just like, "I can't with you and your ways." I'm like, "This is how I operate." So she's like, "Yeah." So I think that was the first time I was fired as a client.
Yeah. Well, it is fun. It is a relationship like any other relationship. And, it
Yeah,
has to be a good relationship to
has to be a
put your
good relationship
business
because
together.
you were literally business partners. And so even to this day, even though I have my current agent, my former agent, even now that she's even back in the business, I still look out for her because like several of my contracts were through hers, which means she still gets paid through those contracts. So I keep a great working relationship with all of us, and yeah, because it's like, hey, I've told you I was ride or die with you no matter what. So here we are still.
That's it. That's what's so important too, just to keep good relationships and with the people who are still getting your money.
Right, right.
So now you have all these books out. Are you still working a day job? Like most of
The short answer is yes,
Yes.
but, and there's a huge but there. So I am the librarian at this is a private Christian school. I'm their librarian because I helped restore the Paul Laurence Dunbar Library in that space. And so it's a historic library. It was like the first library to serve the Black community in Indianapolis. So I helped restore that build, restore that space, and then I'm the librarian of that space. But it looks an off and so on the practical side of things is I get my benefits through that position. And then the other practical side of it, like literally the job is the school's paying me to get my writing done on the clock.
Perfect.
So I was like, I'm good. So even if I don't actually sell anything, my time is being paid for.
Yeah.
So I'm fine. And then I also do work through a place, an organization called the Kepler Institute, which is
Yes.
it's a grassroots community organization. It's basically focused on community wealth building by investing in young leaders. So a lot of my job is just more mentorship. So I'm mentoring at the school essentially through teaching. I am mentoring in the community through the Kepler Institute. I'm not actually not in Indianapolis right now. I'm in another city because one of my first students I ever taught is now graduating from college, and he was having his senior show, and so I surprised him by showing up at a show last night.
Nice.
So apparently I'd never get out of the mentoring business.
Yeah. Well, good mentors are so important for, I mean, what you had them and passing that on is fantastic.
Exactly.
And that is a great segue because I saw you dedicated your book to the Kepler Institute. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So when I was first coming up with the idea for the After Black trilogy, and again, it's a not I was pitching to a friend, and the friend was like, "You got any ideas?" And I was just like, "Oh yeah, like sort of like Tales from the Hood, except with throughout the galaxy, type thing." And she was just like, "Yeah, write that up as an outline. Let's do that as a book." And I'm like, "Okay." And so and that became the After Black trilogy. But the world building for it was sort of like a community thought exercise. And so through the Kepler Institute, I was kept asking in different spaces we were in, it's like, hey, what if we win? Right? What would the world look like if we could build a community on our terms? So, what's the kind of future we'd like to see? And in fact, what is it we're actually working towards? So how do we reimagine things like the education system and economics and governance? And how do we rethink cultural priorities so that, in fact, what emerged from that conversation was the fact that people were saying, like, what if artists and scientists and teachers were like the highest aims for people? And then having like this intergenerationally led community. And then what if like the starships were powered by jazz music? Because
Because, why not?
exactly. Because what I remind people, like, we create with a blank page,
Yeah.
right? So I can have starships powered by jazz music because. And so that's how the world of Moongano was born. And I consider Moongano, the community itself, is the main character of the series, right? And so, and the reason I dedicated it to the Kepler Institute is because Moongano is basically the Kepler Institute, except instead of just being a community, a neighborhood or organization, it's now an intergalactic community. And so, all right, so now what does it look like as this intergalactic community?
Yeah, I think that's so wonderful. And I've kind of loved sci-fi has been traditionally a bit more community based, whereas fantasy was more individualistic, but has had a huge shift towards, stronger together, which is kind of
Right.
cool to see. So I love the idea of the community as like the main character, and that's
Yeah.
amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so okay, this is your third book. How has that journey been writing a whole trilogy and
it's just I'm laughing because like all right, so like you got book one, right? So Swoop
yeah.
of Stars. And so you have and the big theme of Sweep of Stars is we are establishing this culture, right? And so you have this generational starship that's exploring this wormhole. You have this what I call the HOVA, which is their military unit, and they're exploring this world on the other side of the wormhole. There's this murder mystery that's going on because one of the leaders gets assassinated. And so you have all this politics of secession going on, and so you have that all that's going on in book one. So, and then in book two, in Breath of Oblivion, the big theme is, all right, so what does it look like to carry the culture with you no matter where you go? So you could be imprisoned on a secret black site on some on a planet. You could be on another planet learning this ancient magic system. You could be caught between two warring alien factions. Or just flat out lost on the far side of the galaxy, right? And so, that's or be at ground zero as you've got this war brewing between original Earth and Moongano. So I'm just like, all right. So book two, I'm just going wherever I want to go in book two. Book three comes around, and it's like, uh-oh, I have to wrap all these
Yeah.
storylines up. Bring everybody back together, bring the band back together, and tie everything up in a nice, neat little bow. And then that was the part that I was just like, I have no idea what I'm gonna do to get all these. Because like I said, everybody's scattered through space and time at this point.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but then City Dreaming comes together, and so the major theme of it is, what does it look like to use your culture as a weapon of res as your chief weapon of resistance? And so. So the process is a matter of like, all right, how do we get everybody? I know you're over here. I got to get you over here. I know you're over there. I got to get you back over here. And I know I'm trying not to do too many spoiler things, but let's just say some people were lost in time, but I got to get you from there back to here.
Yeah.
And so the whole book is and then again thematically tie things up. And so yeah, it was
It's a
yeah.
lot.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
That's it, doing a book is a lot, but then yeah, doing the series and getting the whole arc and making each one satisfying and tying it all up is a challenge.
Yeah.
Did you outline it or are you pantser?
I'm more outliner than pantser.
Okay.
Because but even that, because like when I sold Sweep of Stars, I had to turn in an outline, but even as I
Yeah.
turned it in, I said, "You do know this is the lie we're all agreeing to, right?"
Yeah.
And everybody's like, "Yeah, we know how it goes." And I'm like, "Okay, so even though here's the outline, this is just the stuff I'm pretty sure is going to happen. Don't know if and that's all that's going to happen." And
Yeah.
sure enough, everybody had like their little side quests and everything on their way to the resolution. And frankly, my editor was just like, "Yeah, I did." I did not see that ending coming at all. I mean, it makes perfect sense, but nope, didn't see that
That's always a good thing when you can surprise your
Right.
editor, right?
Right. Exactly.
That's awesome. Well, that's great. And so that's wrapped up. And what's next? Can you talk about your next project?
Yeah. So A City Dreaming officially comes out at the end of June.
Yeah, and this will be that'll be airing on your pub date. So hello, it's going to
Okay.
be out now for everyone who's listening.
Perfect. But I say that because at the end of January, my next book drops. And
Okay.
so that's a sci-fi thriller. It's me and Wayne Brady have written a book together. And it's called Hard Times. And it's basically about a father and son. The son has been disappeared by a small town sheriff. And so the father's trying to find him. And the son, so on one side, you got the father's looking for his son because they've had an estranged relationship, but his son's missing, so it's like all that stuff is forgotten. Let me find my son. I need not a chance to make things right. On the son's side of things, when the sheriff tosses him into jail, the jail is actually a portal and it sends him back in time to a 1950s prison farm.
Ooh.
And so the son's trying to figure out how to escape this 1950s prison farm while the father's in the present trying to look for the son. So it's a fun book.
That is fun. You had me at jail portal, so I'm in on
Right.
that one. So, how did you get writing with Wayne Brady? How did this happen?
I love this as an origin story. He had taken a deep dive into Afrofuturism
Okay.
and was wanting to learn more about different Afrofuturist writers. He came across my name and then ran across Kingmaker, the book I was telling you about at the very beginning. And so he read Kingmaker and then reached out to me over Twitter and goes, "Hey, I just read Kingmaker. I just want you to know I'm a huge fan."
Oh, that's awesome.
And I all but printed out that tweet and put it on a t-shirt because I was just like, "Hey, y'all." I mean, none of my people could talk to me for like a week. I'm like, Wayne Brady's a fan of mine. How you like me now? That sort of thing. And so, but then he reached out and just like, "Hey, would you ever have time to sit around and talk story ideas?" And I was just like, "Sure." And then when we got to talking, turns out at the end of the day, it's just two nerds getting together. I start talking about different books, and it was over. The first meeting was over Zoom, and so I'd mention a book, and like he would just reach off camera. And then pull the book into view. Goes, "You mean this book?" And then I'd do another mention another book. He'd reach off camera again and pull it back into view and goes, "You mean this book?" And I'm like, "Oh, you one of us, one of us." Okay.
That's when you
And
know the
so,
collab's gonna work, right? You're on
and
the
that's when you know
same.
it's gonna work. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And so then yeah. And so he gave me the pitch for Hard Times. Well, actually gave me three different pitches, and I was like, "I think Hard Times is the move." And then he's like, "Hey, you want to write it together?" And I'm like, Yeah, let's do that." And so that's what we end up doing.
That's very cool. So excited for that collab to come out, and yeah, I'm wishing you all the success with that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Man, we're getting now we haven't even talked about you've done some IP work for Marvel's Black Panther. You want to talk about
Yes.
that? Yeah. We should talk about that.
Yeah, I guess we could squeeze that in.
Yeah.
So it was right in the middle of me writing the Astro Black trilogy that Marvel reaches out and is like, "Hey." I think at this point I'd done some other IP work. I'd written a short story, a Black Panther short story for them. I think I'd either had already or was had been just been asked to write a Captain America short story for them. I'd done work in Aliens versus Predators, and I think there was one other IP I had done work on. And then Marvel's just like, "Who are you? I mean, you're just popping up in all these different publishing spaces that we're connected to. Who are you?" So they were like, "Well, we want to do a we're interviewing some writers for this Black Panther project. So can we schedule an interview with you?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." And so when the interview comes up, I'm still at school at the time, and so the camera comes on, and so in my classroom. Like all the kids would always say, if they come to my classroom, the running joke was, "Oh, we got to go to Wakanda," because my classroom has all these African print curtains. I have all these masks hanging up, and then plus all this Black Panther memorabilia all through my classroom. So the camera comes on, and got all these Marvel folks in there, and they're like, "Oh, you must have prepped for this interview." And I'm like, "No," and they're like, "Well, we see all that Black Panther stuff," and I'm like, "No, this is how my room looks all the time." And you could tell they didn't buy it. And so then I reached behind me, I go, "So this," and I pull down this picture. And it's a portrait of Chadwick Boseman. And I said, this was done by one of my students when Chadwick passed. Because she said, well, if Black Panther just died, I know Mr. Broaddus is going to feel some way. So I made this for him. And normally I choke up, when I even talk about that story. And I said, so yeah, this didn't just happen just because you scheduled this interview with me yesterday. This is my world. And then they go, well, I think our interview process is over.
We're done.
We're
You've got
done. You got
the
the job. So yes, that's how it came about. And then what ended up happening is obviously all the folks in my world knew that Black Panther's my favorite character, and if I got a chance to write him, it's like, hey, I don't know what to tell y'all, but like the Astro Black trilogy said, nope, we get it. So we'll put a pause on Breath of Oblivion till you get that done. At my middle school series, they were like, nope, we'll put a pause on things till you get that book done. And so I basically had 3 months to write a Black Panther book.
Wow.
Then I got that written, and then all the other books were due. So in a span of about 4 or 5 months, I basically got f three novels done.
A little stressed, just a little
It just woo.
bit.
Ooh, yeah, it was
Oh.
a rough, it's a rough summer.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that. I mean, you've had such a fantastic career. I appreciate you coming on and sharing it with us.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Just as we're wrapping up, we like to ask everyone one question. If you could give some advice to newer or aspiring writers, what would you say?
I know the first thing I impart on my students is the first thing that was imparted on me from my high school teachers, because the big thing that they said was writers finish things. And so like with and I know how easy it is to always want to write that the hot shiny thing, but writers finish things. And so it became my discipline and my practice to like if I start something, I finish that something. If I write a novel pitch, for example, and the pitch is usually like the first three chapters and an outline, once I send that in, I'm gonna go ahead and go and finish that book because writers finish things. And so I have a whole trunk of just finished projects because you have to have that discipline of beginning, middle, end, beginning, middle, end, beginning, middle, end, because that's how you move forward with things. So, and you get that practice down. Suddenly, this whole three books in a 5 month span. I mean, it was rough, but I have that discipline of beginning, middle, end, beginning, middle, end. So I'm just like, no, I know how to do this. And I just got to learn to just trust that process.
All right. So I love Maurice's philosophy on publishing. Make friends, figure out business later.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
That's my whole operating system. I never think about business until we've already broken bread together.
That is definitely how you do a conference.
Yeah,
Yeah.
for sure.
Yeah. This guy ticks me off in a good way though, because I'm like, oh
How?
man, I could have had that career. I could have done all the things he did, and I went a slightly different path. So I'm only ticked off that he got the kind of career I always wanted. I would love to write for comics. Yeah.
I loved his stories. Just like everyone supported me. I had great mentors. Everything
Yeah.
worked out. I'm like, man.
They put him in a corner at school and let him write books and stuff all day. I mean,
Did that happen to anyone else or any of you troublemakers who were done early and are like, here's the
well,
novel?
yes. Yeah, I did. I did. I mean, I did. I was constantly being put aside and told, here's some paper, here's some pens, go write something, draw something. Because I ended up in the alternative campuses every now and then. That's where you go when you're the bad kid, you get in trouble.
I was given a lot of free reading time, but for the opposite reason, because I did my work fast and I was rewarded for reading, and I really liked that reward. And so I continued to be a good student and get my work done so that I could finish reading books.
See, that's the thing. They kept putting me off by myself, thinking it was a punishment, not realizing that that's what I wanted all
Maybe they knew.
along.
Maybe they knew.
So he's done a lot of cool things. Yeah, a lot of
A lot of origin stories.
lot of origin stories. But I was just like, oh, I just think the wildest thing is that just like Wayne Brady DMs you in your social media. It's like, hey, you want to
Yeah.
write something with me? Have you ever had anyone reach out to you like that, just out of the blue? JD, I'm looking at you. You must have had this happen.
I have, but I'm trying to think of one that I'm actually allowed to talk about because they're all related to memoirs. So I got phone calls from some, people like totally out of left field. I mean, I got one yesterday that I would love to be able to talk to you about on the air. I'll tell you guys after we hang up, but it's not something
Cool.
I can put out there publicly yet. Just weird stuff tends to come out of left field, I think, in this industry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just yesterday, I got contacted by James Patterson
Oh
asking me
yeah.
to.
And you slid into your DMs?
He
Oh, I
slid
think
into
you
my
slid into my
DMs.
email, but I think he
Hi,
was like, hi.
Kelvin. Jimmy Patterson here. He
Yeah.
went on for a while.
Perfect.
That's cool. What IP work? Have we talked about IP work before? What IP work
A
you would like
little
to do?
bit.
I can't remember. I think the Black Panther thing is hilarious. They just like called him and his whole classroom is Black Panther. You got the job. I'm gonna have to decorate for the job I want. What job are we decorating for?
Dress for the job you want.
I would write naked publicly if they would let me write for Spider-Man.
I think that might be slightly brand incongruent.
Otherwise I'm just doing it for free. But
Right. And that's also
if
a
they let me
problem.
write for Spider-Man, I'd keep doing it.
Spider-Man would be cool. Star Wars would be cool, although everyone's written for Star Wars. That universe is massive.
Yeah. They're pretty strict about their IP too.
We've talked about. I'm still chasing X-Files down.
X Files would be super cool.
You got a second chance at this now that they're doing the
Yeah,
reboot.
they're rebooting.
Yeah, no, I've got people working on that, trying to get me in touch with the right people to make that happen.
Oh, that would be
That would be
cool.
very cool.
Can I write a guest episode?
He's got to write a guest episode. Come on.
Do you
Come
want to write
on.
for the show or like write a book based in the X-Files universe?
No, I've already done that kind of thing. I would like to just write like maybe one episode, like a one-off episode.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
That'd be super
Either way would
cool.
be cool.
I think we should bring back Twilight Zone or Outer Limits and just write some new
Yeah.
episodes.
They kind of did. Are you guys watching? Have you guys watched The Burrows yet on
Not yet.
Netflix? Kara's watching it, but I haven't watched it yet.
The Duffer Brothers, that's like their latest thing. Apparently it already got canceled because they pissed off Netflix and went to Paramount and they can't, it's like it's under their number one streaming show and they canceled it anyway.
Yeah.
But they stole the Twilight Zone music. So like they open with like it's a slight variation on it, but it's clearly from the Twilight Zone.
Really
I keep meaning to
interesting.
like research that to see if they got permission for that or if they just did it or what the deal is.
Or if it's in public domain, or it can't be in public domain. It's not that old.
No, because the movie is still new enough,
Oh,
I think, where it would keep that from happening. So like
yeah.
somebody owns it.
Yeah.
But it could very well be that it's like such a limited number of notes that, you can get away
Yeah.
with it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a show called The Boys on
Oh, I love
Amazon
The
Prime.
Boys. Boys
And
is
there's a
great.
superhero theme that plays whenever this character named Soldier Boy, who's basically supposed to be Captain America, and
Yeah.
every time he comes on screen, they play a theme that sounds a lot like Captain America, but then it sort of goes off like sour
That's
notes and
awesome.
stuff.
I am just jealous of the Biz Markie Day t-shirt. I want one of those, so I have to figure out where to get one of those. And that is a reference for all of you Gen Xers, Biz Markie. Anyway.
He said something in this interview, by the way, that I
Oh,
thought
go
was
ahead.
great about outlines, because he said, this is just the lie we're all agreeing to, right? And then he went and wrote something completely different, and it makes me kind of question, like, what the point of an outline is when they all, you almost invariably go wildly off the outline. And
Yeah,
I
I think
know
it's just part of the
JD's about to
business,
drop
right?
science
Like,
on me about
it's
what
just
it's.
part of the business deal. I think the corporate stuff, like this is a product, and they go, okay. I don't, show you got something tangible.
That happens a lot, I think, with particularly with book authors have a second book deal, like they get signed on the first
Yeah.
one and it's got a second book attached to it, and they just turn in their idea or their outline for the second one and end up writing something totally different. But yeah,
Yeah.
anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as Maury said, writers finish things. So let's finish this episode. JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got David Heska Wambly Whedon coming on. Longest name ever. David's first novel, Winter Counts, won the Anthony Award for Best First Novel, the Thriller Award for Best First Novel, and was nominated for an Edgar. He's back with a sophomore effort, Wisdom Corner. It's a thriller about life and death on the Rosebud Indian Reservation. It releases on July 7th.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.